Well, thank you for the introduction. Today I'll be presenting part of the work for my master's thesis, which focuses on the interactions that take place between ants and soft-scale insects. So soft-scale insects are major pests of trees and shrubs. Their feeding causes damage such as twig dieback, a general weakening of the plant, and severe foliar chlorosis. They also produce large amounts of honeydew, which often lead to extensive growth of sooty mold, and it can also attract a number of stinging insects. So one of the scales that I'm working with is the magnolia scale. This is a native pest to the eastern United States, and it attacks a number of different magnolia trees. You can see here that the leaves are completely covered with the black sooty mold. The scale I'll be talking about primarily today is the calico scale. This is an introduced pest from eastern Asia, and it attacks a wide range of trees. As you can see here, the tree has suffered from severe defoliation. So looking at the life cycle of the calico scale, if you start in the spring, you'll find the adult females on the twigs and branches of the trees. Then in May, they start to produce eggs. Here, an adult female has been flipped over, and you can see there are thousands of eggs under her body. So the eggs hatch, and then the crawlers move to the leaves, where they settle and feed throughout the summer, and molt into the second instar. Then in the fall, they move from the leaves back to the twigs and branches, where they settle and remain throughout the winter. And in the spring, they molt again to become adults and begin to swell. So it's well known that many honeydew-producing homopterans have formed these mutualistic relationships with ants. And in these relationships, the ants use honeydew as a source of sugar and various nutrients. And in return, the ants provide the honeydew producers with a variety of services. However, the most commonly recognized service provided by ants is the protection from natural enemies. So my objective is to evaluate the success of calico scale in the presence and the absence of ants. And with that, I'm essentially asking the question, can ants exclusion effectively control soft scale infestations? And my hypothesis is that ant exclusion will eliminate ant-provided enemy-free space and lead to a decline in the scale populations. My study site is located at a horse farm in Kentucky that has numerous sugar maples that are heavily infested with calico scale. And if you look at these trees, you'll see there are just tons of ants all over the place running up and down these trees. And those ants are a species within the genus Formica. And this picture just shows what we are seeing as we're looking into the trees. You can see the branches are just covered with these scales. So in the spring, I examined each tree to estimate the level of infestation, and then I paired the trees according to infestation and their proximity to one another. And I ended up with 6 replications. So within each pair, I randomly selected one to be the control in which ants were allowed access to the scales, and in the other tree, the ants were excluded. And this was done at the time of initial honeydew production. So I excluded the ants by applying these bands to the trees, which consisted of burlap, duct tape, and tanglefoot, a real sticky substance that traps the ants. And just as for experimental purposes, to ensure that the ants did not have access to the scales, I also sprayed the base of those trees with Tall Star, a contact insecticide. So to evaluate the effectiveness of my exclusion techniques, I spent 5 minutes at each tree and I counted the number of ants that crossed a line on the tree, and that line was at a height above the bands. I did this on 3 different dates, and on the first date, as you can see, I counted an average of 40 ants per control tree, whereas on the trees that were banded, I counted absolutely no ants. And you can see that I found similar results on the other 2 dates. So this showed that the exclusion techniques were effective. So I excluded the ants throughout the whole summer, and then I went back to at the end of the summer to sample for potential predators. I did this using a beat sheet, and within each tree I struck a total of 8 branches, 8 times each, and then I collected the potential predators with an aspirator and stored them in alcohol. At the same time, I also counted the number of ants that I collected. And this just shows again that the ants were present on the day of sampling and that the exclusion was effective. So I found that in the trees where ants were excluded, there were significantly more green lacewing larvae and spiders. And interestingly, those same trees actually had fewer coccinellate adults, although that number is not significant. The spiders are still being identified, but the dominant families are Araneidae, Tomicidae, and Philodromidae. And all of the lacewing were of the family Chrysopidae. So after seeing there were more lacewing larvae in the absence of ants, I had to ask if they would actually eat the calico scales. And so I set up a number of petri dishes, and each dish had a known number of scales. And in six of the dishes, I placed an individual lacewing larva, and two of the dishes were left without a lacewing. And then I placed them in an incubator for 2 days and left them. So my question was pretty clearly answered. Yes, they will eat the scales. So you can see in the right-hand column, in the absence of the lacewing larva, none of the scales disappeared. But in the presence of the lacewing, I had as much as a 98% disappearance. And this conclusion was further supported by observations under the microscope. So then in the fall, I went back to the trees to see if ant exclusion had an overall effect on the scale densities. And to do this, I counted the number of live nymphs on 50 leaves per tree. I collected the leaves by first taking 10 cuttings off of each tree and then removing 5 leaves per cutting. And because the leaves were variable in size, I also used a template that allowed me to count only the scales within a defined area on each leaf. So my results showed that when ants were excluded, there were 54% fewer scales. And this result was really surprising even to us, since this was only the first year that ants had been excluded. So in conclusion, ant exclusion did lead to an increase in predator densities, and it did lead to a decrease in the scale densities. And the results support the use of ant exclusion as a sustainable management practice for soft scale insects. And this could potentially be used even by homeowners as an inexpensive and safe alternative to pesticides. And I'm hoping that this work will provide valuable contributions to the field of conservation biological control. Now, I just want to take a minute to talk about some of the other interesting things that I've found this summer. I went to several different locations that are infested with both calico scale or magnolia scale, which I mentioned previously. And this table shows a list of the different associations that I found with each of the scales. I don't actually know a whole lot about the biologies of all these ants, but I was able to see some really interesting differences in their behaviors. And the most interesting example was with the species of Tetramorium. Here, as you can see, there's a single adult magnolia scale here, and it is just covered with all these ants. And I came back to this exact same location a few weeks later, and this is what I found. The ants had completely covered the scale with debris from the mulch bed below. And so just because I was curious, I went ahead and brushed away the debris, and I found that the ants would immediately start bringing in more debris. So it was the ants that were doing this. I'm not exactly sure what the reason is, but one guess might be that it provides some protection from natural enemies. So that was the most interesting thing I saw. And to further test my conclusions, I would like to do some similar ant exclusion studies, both with calico scale and with the magnolia scale, at new locations that use or that have different species of ants involved. I'd like to do more sampling of then natural enemies. And I'm also hoping to make some observations of the actual interactions that take place between the ants and the predators. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Yes.
Do you have any reason to assume that if you keep your ant management going on from season to season, that the impact on the scales will become more demonstrable and the population will continue to drop? And do you plan on looking at that in your research along with some new systems?
Sure. The question was, if I continue to exclude the ants, do I have any reason to believe that my results will be, that the scales will continue to decrease and predators will continue to increase? I would guess that yes, that would be the case. I would guess that the predators, as they get a chance to get ahead, that they would produce more and, of course, in the following years continue to increase. And hopefully the scale densities will eventually be at a much lower level. And I do plan to look at that because I'm going to use this same site next year for my second field season. Yes?
Do you think by affecting the soft field by ensure solutions, so to speak, for the ant population, you could actually affect the overall general area producing the ants in and around the whole campus?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Well, since you have a host that's providing cure to the ant colonies, you could actually, by eliminating the soft fields, impact the insects by aiming the ants and feeding on them, by disrupting this balance. You're actually not only affecting the scale, but you're affecting actually the ant population too around the area. So you can look at the ant population percent and the ants either have access or don't have access.
Okay, the question was, if I reduce the number of scales, will that also impact the ants? And I did not have plans of measuring that. I'm not exactly sure how I would go about looking at that. It is an interesting question, though, of the overall ecology of the ecosystem there. But I'm not planning to address that.
We can only take one more question, so make it a good one. You get to pick. Like, we have a lot of hands wagging, but one more question.
Okay, go ahead.
In reference to your last slide, your fire ants have a resilient fit.
They will consume it?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I was hoping someone might be able to give me some feedback on that particular observation. Okay, thank you.
All right, let's give Sarah a hand as well as all the speakers. All right, if you would like to take part in the business meeting, which is where we're going to next, I'd like you to stay and provide some input. There are four topics. I'm going to give them up front so you can start thinking about them. Soliciting submissions, moderators for next year, communication, making sure we communicate well with the program committee, and then format for this session. So after the mass exodus happens, we'll get started there. You know, students can moderate this. I see a lot of students leaving, but we can have student moderators here. So, all right. The first thing I want to talk about is the submission process and soliciting talks for this. In a little bit, it started off to where we had six talks by the time we basically had to put this together. And it was just a pathetic showing. We had very little participation, all right? And so here's the chastising part of this. We need to have participation or this is gonna go away. So we started beating the bushes. Nate beat bushes, I was beating bushes, and then all of a sudden we had too many things coming out of the bushes. And so the Greenhouse and Ornamental Group had agreed to let us use some of their time. And so then we kind of, not only did we have a lot of talks, but then they graciously gave us some of their time. And then what happened is then the program got jumbled and our sessions were, you know, right next to each other instead of being one after the other as we had hoped they were. But the first thing is you have to support this symposium if you want it to stay viable, because if it's all based on the number of submissions, all right, and the participation. The ESA will ask us for how many people are in the room relative to, you know, on average in this room, and they're going to use that to judge whether or not this is something that they're going to continue to support. So I just would make that case. Continue to support this with your students and your projects. All right. Do you have anything to add to the submission part of that?
Well, I would be interested in some feedback on the duration allowed. We had a shorter time each paper than they did in the other room. I personally like longer talks and symposiums, but at the same time, we were kind of on the edge. We didn't want to exclude two or three people to try to increase the length of the presentations for the people who didn't get cut. So it was kind of a delicate balance we had to tread. In the end, we opted for the shorter presentations.
I like the shorter presentations and the greater opportunity for students to present and for us to hear diversity of projects, but you can always follow up later. I very rarely have my students be at President's Prize anymore because the exposure in this symposium, I think, is more valuable to them than talks that are scattered all over the program. And I think this is a great opportunity for me to get to know Albert students or Doug Richmond students or what they're doing and so on. So I think rather than, you know, half as many talks with more time, better.
One thing is, of course, that really there are probably only five or six of the universities that were really well represented with respect to students.
But that's not always been the case in the past.
So we would like to kind of get diversify a little bit.
The ESA will only give us 4 hours. All right, so we're always working with a four-hour time period. What they will do, talking about format, because we are on format issue, they will allow us, if we want, they'll bring posters in here. If we want to have posters, if we want to have a time built into the schedule for informal discussion, like I tried to foster a little bit during this program, that's something else that could be put in here. This is all going to be up to the moderators for next year, but just give me some feedback. Was it worthwhile to have discussions in those dead times after the paper, or was that just, you know, a useful filler? Okay, so maybe then next year we can try and work some of that in.
We can even schedule those into the program.
Yes.
Papers on biological control or resistance or whatever. Set aside 10 to 15 minutes and carry on.
15 minutes of discussion?
Yes. All right. Again, that's not going to allow us to have longer talks because we're putting in, but nonetheless, it will. I really like the discussion we had in the room at that time. So.
Yeah. And we do have a little flexibility. Again, as long as we get it organized, we can run back-to-back sessions between the two, and there's enough overlap that we can do things like move talks and set up special sessions. No reason they have to be separate symposiums.
And you could do panel discussions even. I mean, they'll even set up tables for it that's what these are set up for. I'm assuming if one of the sessions that's going to be in this room will have a panel involved. You can even have that. And the Confex system will allow you to set up those times for panels for informal discussion with the group. So.